You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. As always, I ask that if you listen to or subscribe to the show on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star rating there if you would be so kind, or anywhere else where you can do so. That'd be great. Also, I invite you to join me on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. Before we get into this week's episode, we have another email to talk about from a listener. This one comes from Jim in Virginia. It's a great email. Jim writes, I love the podcast, big fan of the show. One thing that has been bothering me about the whole premise of the money pit is that if you were in possession of such a treasure that you would go to such great lengths to devise a flood tunnel system to protect it and then leave not knowing who may stumble upon it, would you ask yourself the question, what if we come back and the tunnel has been flooded? If you were holding key writings, such as Shakespeare's manuscript, would you really take a chance of them getting flooded? Not counting those, assuming you knew the key to shutting the flood tunnels off, what kind of system would you need to drain the water out of the pit? How much manpower would it entail? If it was flooded, wouldn't you be concerned that whoever flooded it would be waiting for your return? I also think it would be something that just keeps caving in on itself, like what the historical searchers have found out. I'm sure this was thought of, but I haven't seen it mentioned much. Thanks for the great podcast. Keep up the good work. And that's, again, from Jim in Virginia. Okay, this is a great email. It really gives me a chance to discuss some of those things that, God, whenever I'm, you know, running into people and who are not really into the show, don't listen to the, don't watch the show a lot, don't know all that much about Oak Island, just kind of the basic premise. You get a lot of questions like this, and it really gives us a chance to truly discuss some of the most often asked questions you hear from people who are really maybe new to this whole Oak Island thing, or even someone who just isn't, you know, all in, so to speak, on all this. Jim is really speaking for a lot of people I run into who just haven't really been convinced yet. Not that they don't want to be, just they just haven't yet, and they have some pretty obvious questions. So let's break it down and talk about each one of these questions one by one, shall we? First, he asks, and I'm paraphrasing a bit here, why would you build something so elaborate with flood tunnels and such and then leave it behind, not knowing who might stumble upon it before you can return? Well, Jim, in some ways, I think you might be answering your own question here, certainly to some degree. The very idea of building something so elaborate, so well protected, really does in itself indicate someone who wants to ensure the safety of whatever it is, you know, something they may not get back to recover themselves anytime soon. Does that make sense? If you were just hiding something in a place you already knew was relatively secure, for which you knew you'd be, you know, returning in short order, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to build something so crazy as this, a 100-foot deep vault with highly engineered booby traps protecting it from, you know, from any tampering at all. The type of thing we seem to have on Oak Island certainly can be seen as something built by someone who went to great lengths to protect whatever is there for the long haul, and something they may never have thought they themselves could get back to and recover. I mean, this is all assuming, of course, there isn't some yet-to-be-discovered easy way to get at the treasures. A walk-in entrance is a popular theory among Oak Island researchers. You hear a Curse of Oak Island author Randall Sullivan talking about that quite a bit. It's a popular sort of theory by people who are believers. I think this is a good time, though, to mention that literally every answer I'm about to give you, Jim, here is nothing more than pure speculation at best on my part, which is what I love about this email. Also, I'm only taking the side of the believer with these answers just to give you, you know, and other skeptics, not that I know you're a skeptic, Jim, and I'm not using that word skeptic in the pejorative, you know, somebody who just doesn't believe anything. I'm using it more like you know, somebody with natural questions. I'm just trying to give you guys an idea of what people like Rick Lagina and Dan Blankenship and other people who believe in the mystery might think about these subjects. But these are all great questions. I truly don't have answers to any of them. No one really does, but it's fun trying. So let's let's continue. The next question Jim has is, quote, if you were holding key writings such as Shakespeare's manuscripts, would you really take a chance on them getting flooded? Well, I think the simple answer is you really wouldn't take that chance on almost all circumstances unless you were convinced you had the ability to preserve those important papers from just such a potential disaster. That's right. Francis Bacon, someone often theorized as being somehow involved in all of this, actually experimented, and I believe felt he perfected the idea of preserving parchment in mercury, what he called quicksilver, and being able to do so for, well, I guess forever, I assume. And here we arrive at one of those truly maddening things about Oak Island, those things that make us watch, read, or, you know, frankly, produce podcasts about this mystery. At first glance, the idea of burying paper in a potentially flooded out vault would seem to any sensible person like total nonsense. But wait, here comes a theory, and not just a theory, a good one. Here comes Francis Bacon and his quicksilver. And then suddenly it just doesn't seem so nonsensical anymore. That's really the way around all of this, the way down into the hole that is the Oak Island search. Jim's next question is, quote, assuming you knew the key to shutting the flood tunnels off, what kind of system would you need to drain the water out of the pit? Well, Jim, that's a great question too, because honestly, I'm not sure I've ever heard a theory about getting or even needing to get the water back out of the pit before attempting to recover the treasure from a vault that's, you know, submerged beneath the water. Mostly, the theories that I hear involve secret ways to bypass the flooding by entering from a different angle or from beneath the vault. You know, almost every shaft besides the money pit, and we'll get to one later on in the show, almost all of them built on Oak Island was dug for this very purpose. And a lot of people believe that there is a purpose-built one by the depositors that achieves this, that gets to the vault while not ever having to encounter the flooding. But who knows? You know, maybe the key is draining it out some way. You know, it's an interesting idea, Jim, and one worth thinking about as we move on here. Next, he asks, quote, how much manpower would it entail? And in this question, Jim, that lies the true head scratcher in all of this. I mean, it's the reason why you can just dismiss a boat full of a couple of pirates, right? The answer is a tremendous amount of manpower. And even if we don't fully understand the extent to which the money pit or the flood system was engineered or constructed, just what it took, just look at Smith's Cove, which we do have a very good understanding of, a very good historical and documented understanding of. It's an area of something like 165 feet of beach that was completely dug out. Boulders, giant boulders found everywhere else, almost everywhere else on Oak Island, removed and relocated inland from off the beach. And then this entire area covered with eelgrass and coconut fiber before being covered back up. I had to go get that eelgrass and coconut fiber, by the way. And all this is done with hand tools and shovels. Just that alone would take an incredible amount of work. I've heard people say, you know, an entire season, a summer season, just to do the workings on Smith's Cove. And we pretty much know for sure that this work was done. We can do that through excavation. We can still see a lot of that excavation nowadays. And if there really is a box drain that extends from the beach 100 plus feet down into the earth across hundreds of yards leading all the way to the money pit, I mean, my God, it's crazy to even think about just the idea of doing it. To repeat, the short answer is a tremendous amount of manpower, but it does seem that manpower was indeed spent, at least to some extent. Again, Smith's Cove is really the proof of that. This was a tremendous effort, a tremendous work project by people with very, you know, without excavators and power tools and things like that. Next question, quote, if it was flooded, wouldn't you be concerned that whoever flooded it would be waiting for your return? Now, that's assuming, Jim, whoever did this had a choice. And that's the key here. At the very least, I would think such an elaborate and difficult project was not the first choice of the depositors, but rather some extraordinary and perhaps even desperate, you know, circumstances led them to do this, to create whatever this was. Obviously, these folks must have known they ran the risk of not getting back in time before it was looted, or even at all for that matter, but for whatever reason they felt they needed to take these incredible measures to ensure the safety of whatever was there and keep it out of anyone else's hands. The best basic theory I've heard about this, the one that might answer that kind of skepticism, it goes something like this. And we've discussed this on previous shows. A ship is filled with treasure, sails into Mahone Bay, perhaps not on purpose, but as a result of a storm or maybe even running from an enemy. And before either sailing into dangerous enemy waters or perhaps continuing their journey on what was, you know, essentially a severely damaged vessel, they decided to deposit whatever they had on board on the island for safekeeping with hopes that they or someone they were associated with would return and recover it. Maybe it was just too much weight for a ship that had been damaged. You know, maybe the risk was too much that if they sailed into enemy territory, the treasure and the ship would be captured and lost. So this was the best of bad choices. And then for one reason or another, they never made it back to Oak Island and likely were never heard from again. Either the boat sank in a storm or was destroyed in this battle. I would think that in a situation like that, the important thing to remember is their assessment was that the risk of losing whatever they were carrying was significantly lessened by building an elaborate booby trap vault rather than continuing with it on board the vessel. Does that make sense? Essentially, they stood a better chance of holding on to it by securing it in Oak Island than continuing it with it in the hold of their ship. Again, this is complete speculation, but work with me here. We are trying to speculate on this for sure. Jim ends with this comment. I also think it would be something that just keeps caving in on itself, like what the historical searchers have found out. I'm sure this was thought of, but I haven't seen it mentioned much. You know what, Jim? These are all great, very logical questions. Ones that open a lot of questions and potential holes in popular theories, and those are just the type of questions the History Channel does not want to get into, for obvious reasons when you think about it. Some people over the years have pointed out that, in fact, these workings have caved in on themselves. The cave-in pit, which we see a lot now, finally, on the show, being the best example of this, but there are others. It seems that perhaps the Laginas are closer now to really showing us some of the elements of the flood tunnel system, and not just this speculative drawings that we see. I really look forward to that. I think that'll be an interesting way to sort of better get a mental picture of what may have been built here. Built properly, such a system may not constantly be caving on itself. But, you know, until I see what's actually down there, it's impossible for us to say. It's a great observation for sure. Let's see where it all ends up. Hopefully this season will give us some of those answers. Jim, thank you so very much for this great email. I love stuff like this. It really makes you think about these things that we talk about every week. It opened the discussion up to a lot of areas we don't really often get to discuss here, and I really appreciate that. Thank you for listening, for the kind words about the show. If you'd like to email me your thoughts or questions as well, you can do so at digginoakisland@gmail.com. And who knows, perhaps we'll discuss it and answer it right here on the podcast. Thanks again, Jim. Now it's time to get into episode 8 of season 7 of The Curse of Oak Island. Let me say right off the bat that this episode review I'm going to do here is going to be one of the shorter ones, a lot shorter than most of the others I've done. There isn't a whole lot of new information here in this episode, and certainly not a whole lot of stuff that we haven't covered a lot already. A lot of these things I'll try to mention as we go along, we've talked about sort of extensively in the past. The episode is entitled Triptych. If you didn't already know, a triptych, which is Greek for something like three folds or something like that, I think, it's a painting, or really any type of art medium, I suppose, that is created in three separate panels. They're kind of hung together. They're often hinged together as well and could kind of fold on top of itself. They're very popular for altar pieces, around about the Middle Ages and extending for the next few centuries after that. It is a not entirely correct word to use, or sort of nice title for the crackpot session, which seems to be the reason why we titled this triptych. For this week's crackpot session in the war room, I really have to stop saying crackpot session. That's sort of my wife's joke, and I truly and honestly don't think these folks are at all crackpots. And for Corian Moll, the theorist in the War Room today, it seems pretty obvious that producers and editors do not help in his attempt to not look like a crackpot. I'll get to that in a second. But if you haven't figured it out, the scene that I'm starting off with here is our sort of War Room theory session, where Rick and Marty and maybe one or two others talk to somebody who has an elaborate theory on how the treasure could be found or what the treasure might be. And this comes from a man named Corian Moll. Moll's theory revolves around French painter Nicolas Poussin. Poussin was born in June of 1594 in Normandy, and he died in 1665 in Rome. He was a classical-minded artist working during the what we would call the French Baroque period. He worked most of his life in Rome and focused his paintings on what we might refer to now as sort of historical subjects, mostly biblical in origin, but there was also a lot of like tales of ancient history and ancient legends and that kind of thing. He worked directly for King Louis XIII, as well as the King of Spain at that time as well, and obviously the Vatican, since he was working much of this time while living in Rome and did things for churches. Needless to say, he was very well-connected as an artist could be, but the process of commissioning and stuff like that, many artists back then were. Moll's theory is based on the idea that Poussin, being as connected as he was, knew that apparently not very well kept secret now that the Knights Templar found the Ark of the Covenant and buried it on an island in Nova Scotia. I say not very well kept secret facetiously because it just seems like so many people have come into this information as we go on through the years here. The proof of this comes in the form of his of three of his paintings, two of which were separate pieces hung together like a triptych, but not because it's only two. Which makes me wonder why they called the episode triptych. Anyway, I guess that's not really important. The two that were painted together were 1627's Et in Arcadia Ego, also known or referred to on the show as The Shepherds of Arcadia. And also another one from that same, painted at the same time, Midas Washing at the Source of the Pactolus, which is also named incorrectly on the show. I'm not really sure why that is, but it is. The third was Poussin's second version of The Shepherds of Arcadia, which he painted 11 years later in 1638. Now, Moll's theory goes like this. Each of these three, and it's important to note we are only talking about three of many of Poussin's works. In these three, Moll finds, or thinks he finds, various clues hinting to the idea that Poussin somehow knew or had the knowledge that the Templars had taken the Ark of the Covenant to Canada, Oak Island, I guess. I'm not going to name all the clues here. There's no reason to repeat all that. Go back and have a look if you want to. That's one of the few things about this theory that they actually take some time to show us that the editors haven't chopped out. You can actually see the paintings, and he points to some of the things that he believes, although I'm sure there are many. And that, like many such theories, and there are literally dozens of these. I mean, we have seen supposed clues to the whereabouts of the Oak Island treasure and everything from major works of art like this to, you know, ancient astrological maps, the plays of Shakespeare, I mean, all sorts of things. All these beg many, many questions. But the one I can never get past is, why would he do this? Even if we do accept that somehow Poussin knew this secret, this painter from centuries after the Templars disbanded, somehow knew the Templars took the treasure or the Ark of the Covenant to Oak Island, why would he put clues to this in his painting? To what end would he do something like that? It's something that always puzzles me about these theories. I mean, we have this huge theory, which we talked about in a previous episode. If you go back and listen to the one about called the Oak Island Enigma, it's called Francis Bacon and the Oak Island Enigma, I think it's called. You know, there's so many theories, and we've been presented with a few of these about how the Shakespeare manuscripts have coded ciphers in them where you can find the information. It makes you wonder, why do that? What if you want to hide this from people, why put anything out there? Just the logic in it just is lost on me. You know, email me if I'm wrong. Here's the thing about Corian Moll and all these people who present these theories on the Curse of Oak Island, and I think Mr. Moll more than almost everyone I've seen recently. You could see just from watching this episode just how much they edited and chopped out of his presentation. I mean, to the point where I can really give zero honest critical analysis of his work or his theories or his ideas. He may have answers to things like, you know, the obvious questions, how Poussin would know about the treasure, what connections exactly would he have had to the treasure or to the depositors, and so on and so on. But those answers are all left out for the interest of time. There's a point in the episode where Marty says something, maybe it was Rick who says something, oh, well, you're so very well researched. And so, but we didn't see any of that. All we saw was sort of the basics and then smiles and off to the next thing. But those answers are, to these kind of obvious questions are all seemingly left out just for the interest of time. I mean, I suppose that's why it was. And also the purpose of quickly presenting something to the viewer that might somehow relate to a discovery that appears later on that same episode. And that's exactly what happened here. Don Johnson and Steve Watson, who are from Global GPR Services Incorporated, are back on Oak Island to do a ground-penetrating radar scan of the swamp, a place where Mole feels Poussin's clues point to the location of the treasure. The scan picks up an anomaly. And yep, we've all heard that one before, haven't we? It's about 10 feet deep, about 20 feet wide. It's in the swamp. Once again, permit issues are keeping them from draining and digging, so they can only do a scan and offer up more maddening clues, but it seems to be in the spot that maybe Mole's theory, you know, points to. As I think I've said on the show before, this anomaly stuff, whether it be in the swamp or anywhere else, is really starting to feel like Charlie Brown in the football. But every clue is worth looking into. Now let's get back to Smith's Cove. Smith's Cove is obviously going to play a big role in this season, as it did in last season. We can see that already 8 episodes in. This time the team has bumped out the cofferdam. I think it was like 50 feet or something like that. It's just to sort of get to the end of the supposed slipway or wharf that they found last year. I'm sure you remember that. In a previous episode, they discovered another wooden structure, this time almost directly beyond the slipway, just directly further out from the slipway. After excavating a bit more here in this episode, they discovered it looks kind of like a wooden box, a big one, and could likely be the top of a shaft. That's what it seems to be. And on the seaward side of it, they discover rocks piled up in this sort of unnatural way, which, again, we've seen before in the French drain systems and that kind of stuff that we've, you know, that the team has opined on in previous discoveries. Either way, Terry Matheson, the geologist, considers it certainly to be man-made, so it is of interest for sure, and it's right next to this wooden box. Now, it's impossible to know exactly what the rocks are at this point, but we do know about the wooden part of all this. And one thing I can tell you for sure, or at least as sure as I can be, is that it is not original. Meaning this particular structure, this wooden structure, must be from a searcher and from more modern times. Now, why do I say that? Well, if you haven't been listening, the show likes to remind us and replay so many things from past episodes. I hear that criticism on social media all the time. But some stuff they seem to sort of like to forget, you know, just sort of like push to the side. Such as the fact that when this wooden structure was first found, they found tar paper attached to it. Right when it was first unearthed, the front of it, the seaward side of it, was covered in tar paper. And despite what you might hear from the narrator, or anyone else for that matter, using words like pre-searcher or what have you, because they don't have any records of it, always keep this tar paper in mind. Folks, this structure was probably built in the 1800s at the very earliest, probably a lot later, and certainly not by the Templars or whoever you might want to think. Later on in the show, we seem to do, we see them do some dendrochronology testing. This is the tree ring testing used to determine the age of a timber. They do it on a different object, but they don't do any of that testing on the timbers they find in this structure. Timbers that seem to be intact and pretty ripe for that kind of testing. It's probably not a coincidence that they don't do that. And took more on that test in just a minute. And maybe I'll be wrong and eat some crow in the next couple of months. We'll see. Rick Laginas says the new structure that he found, the wooden box in Smith's Cove, looks like something the Restalls would have built. Now, if you don't know, Robert Restall and his family led the search on Oak Island from 1959 until 1965, and much of what they did can still be seen and learned about today. They're probably most famous now, Robert certainly probably most famous now, and his son for being two of the six who have died in the money pit itself in the effort to search for the treasure. Now, there are plenty of photos and even written records the Restalls kept of their work, and much of that is still around. Having looked at a lot of these photos myself, I think Rick's opinion here seems pretty on point. They do seem to tend to build these sort of timber-based structures to do their work. But it's kind of a head-scratcher anyway if they, in fact, did build this, but yet, for some reason, didn't take any records of it or even bothered to snap a few pictures. I mean, considering how far off the beach this structure is, and the team makes this point a few times, it would have been something of a major and difficult project for the Restalls to do, you know, using tar paper and tree trunks. You would think they would have kept something to record it, especially if they dug a shaft way out there. And they did a lot of work on this beach, and like I said, there's a lot of photos that are still survive. They're in books and all over the place. But all that I've searched through since you know, seeing this structure at first, I don't see anything that looks like this. I mean, I'm hoping to come across something and kind of crack this code a little bit. But needless to say, it looks like the Restalls built a structure out there to try to find a way to shut off the flood tunnel system, which seems to be right in front of it. I mean, that seems to be obvious. It might not be the Restalls, it just sort of looks that way. Like I said, if we do some dating on this on these timbers, we might get some answers, but who knows if that'll ever happen. Now, that does not account, none of what I'm saying accounts for the rocks in the same general area I mentioned before, just on the seaward side. That's clearly not the work of the Restalls, nor does it seem to account for the old iron crib spike that Gary Drayton found in the spoils from the diggings in that area. But we can really put those two things aside for now until we get some more information on that. And there's precious little to glean from any of that stuff just yet. This is a huge project in Smith's Cove, and we're only partway through with it. There's more to come on this for sure. Now, finally, I told you this was going to be a short review here. Finally, we return to the search for the original location of the money pit. Talk about a project that is going to last a while, folks. This one has been going on for decades. But perhaps, we're getting just a little bit closer to achieving the goal of finding the money pit than ever really before. If you recall, before the holiday break, Doug Kroll thought he found, or at least had a good idea, of where one might find Shaft 2. Just to refresh your memory, Shaft 2 is exactly what it sounds like it is. It's the second shaft ever dug on Oak Island after the money pit. It was dug in, I think, 1804 or so, and about 14 feet away from the money pit and down to a depth of 110 feet, where they then began tunneling horizontally towards what they perceived as the location of the treasure vault. It was the first of many attempts to bypass the booby trap by, you know, doing exactly this. Now, in this episode, the team performs some core drilling samples in the area where Kroll suggested they look, and they quickly find wood in samples from only about 20 feet or so down, maybe a little bit more, and deeper at a depth, I think I said about 100 feet or maybe even a bit more than 100 feet, I think. They pull out really like a nice size piece of a timber. Now, this timber is the one they send for that dendrochronology testing I mentioned before. And it comes back with a very interesting date of 1796. The idea here is that since we know Shaft 2 was dug in 1803 or 1804, give or take a year, and this wood is from close to that, this must be wood from Shaft 2. Now, I know there is a 7 or 8 year gap there. That could be a margin of error in the test, or who knows? I don't know why you would chop down a tree and let it sit there for 8 years, so... But I'm not completely familiar with the accuracy of dendrochronology. I thought it was pretty darn accurate, so there is a question in there. It's hard to say, if I'm honest, so let's not dwell too much on that. Now, this is all very exciting and very fascinating for all of us. But my dear listener, you and I have talked many, many times about a man named Robert Dunfield. He's a treasure hunter from California who dug a giant crater in the area of the money pit. And I mean a giant crater. I've told this story so many times, I'm going to let someone else tell you today. This comes from the book, The Secret Treasure of Oak Island by Darcy O'Connor. Now, if you don't call, O'Connor, who was on the show recently, is one of the true giants of the modern Oak Island hunt. He has been researching and writing about the island literally for decades, probably more than anyone else alive. And like I said, he's been on the show a couple of times, including earlier this season. Now, here is what O'Connor writes about the work Dunfield did on the money pit in 1965. He writes, he eventually created a pit almost 140 feet deep and 100 feet across. In the course of digging it, he scooped out most of the timbers from early shafts, leaving only the head and shaft intact. Dunfield later refilled the huge hole he had spent 2 months digging in order to gain a suitable surface for which to do some core drilling in the same spot. So basically, for a hole 100 feet wide, 140 feet deep, he dug it all out and then put it all back in again. I mean, as you could see, it's truly difficult to square the idea of finding wood samples at 25 feet, and even finding them 100 feet, and those samples being anything more than just the remains of, you know, Dunfield's destruction. For many reasons, which I don't want to get into now, and there's a lot of different information out there and a lot of ideas, Dunfield probably never reached the treasure vault or the depth of the treasure vault, despite this incredible crater and the effort it must have taken to do it. Even Dunfield himself believed his crater didn't make it all the way down, and he continued drilling in the area afterwards, like we mentioned. But still, how could Shaft 2, dug only 15 feet at the most away from the money pit, still be intact, knowing what we know about Dunfield's digging? It's a good question. I'm not saying it's impossible, because who knows how Dunfield dug, and he's probably making sort of a cone-shaped crater as he goes down closer and closer to his target, so maybe at certain depths it is okay. But it's a question worth asking, and it's a question the show should be examining. Why is Dunfield's crater hardly ever mentioned on The Curse of Oak Island? That is a great question. So that's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Thanks again for listening. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. If you do enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. Helps get the word out on us. 5-star ratings, please. If you don't want to give us a 5-star rating, email me and tell me why. And also, my heartfelt thanks really to everyone who's done so already. I've had so many great compliments and, you know, great feedback and stuff. Thank you so much for all that. Please, if you don't already do so, follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island. I'm not there all the time, but at least it's a place where you can see my plans coming up for the future, when a new show's out, all that kind of stuff. You can discuss the show, leave your comments, speak to fellow listeners, all that kind of stuff. It's a great place for all that. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. And also, let me just say, if you email me, you are opening that email up to potentially be discussed here on a future podcast. So if you do not want it discussed on a future podcast, please make sure you make a note of that in the email. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for listening to Digging Oak Island.